The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org. James McPherson is one of America's best-known and most admired Civil War historians. He attended graduate school at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, Maryland, and there studied under C. Van Woodward, the preeminent Southern historian. His years of graduate study coincided with the years of Little Rock, New Orleans desegregation, the sit-ins, and freedom rides, and McPherson became increasingly fascinated by the parallels and similarities between the time in which he was living in a border city, in a border state city in the process of trying to improve its race relations and the events that had happened 100 years earlier. He did his PhD dissertation on people whom he called the civil rights activists of the 1860s, the abolitionists, both black and white. His best-known book, which won the Pulitzer Prize, is The Battle Cry of Freedom, a study of the origins of the Civil War and its aftermath. Its title refers to the fact that both the North and the South believed that they were fighting for freedom. In his most recent book, which he'll discuss tonight, Tried by War, Abraham Lincoln as Commander-in-Chief, he illuminates how Abraham Lincoln worked with and often against his senior commanders to defeat the Confederacy and create the role of Commander-in-Chief as we know it today. James M. McPherson is the George Henry Davis, 86, Professor of History Emeritus at Princeton University, and among his many other books are For Cause and Comrades, which won the prestigious Lincoln Prize, and Crossroads of Freedom. Among James McPherson's graduate students at Princeton was a young historian named William Deverell. Tonight, this former student, himself now a historian of stature, will interview his former mentor. And I think they both walked Civil War battlefields together. William Deverell is a professor of history at USC, where he specializes in the history of California and the American West, and directs a scholarly institute that collaborates with the Huntington Library in Pasadena. He's the author of Whitewashed Adobe, The Rise of Los Angeles and the Remaking of Its Mexican Past, and Railroad Crossing, Californians and the Railroad, 1850 to 1910. With Greg Heiss, he is the co-author of Eden by Design, the 1930 Olmsted-Bartholomew Plan for the Los Angeles Region. Our book signing tonight will be a little different. It will be on the stage here, and we'll ask you to line up here after the program. Books that you purchase on sale tonight benefit this program and the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. So without further ado, please welcome James McPherson and William Deverell. Thank you.
Well, good evening, everyone. Thanks for joining us for another wonderful Aloud event. I'm Bill Deverell, and tonight's event, as Louise hinted at, is a real special and particular pleasure for me, as James McPherson was my doctoral advisor and chief mentor in graduate school 20 years ago. He's remained a true professional and personal friend ever since, and this is the first time we've ever been together in a setting such as this. I wish I could say that it makes me feel 20 years younger, but nonetheless, it certainly is a privilege. I'm going to talk to Jim generally for about 45 minutes or thereabouts, then we'll be happy to hear from you all with questions. And we're going to discuss Jim's new book about Abraham Lincoln as Commander-in-Chief. Jim, you write in the beginning of your new book that the Lincoln administration is the only one in presidential history entirely bounded by the war or bounded by war. Do you think it is this fact that makes our look at Lincoln as Commander-in-Chief especially relevant? Or is it our enduring fascination with Lincoln, the man, the leader, or the president, or the thinker?
Well, I think that certainly the fact that Lincoln's entire presidency was preoccupied with the Civil War, something that he didn't necessarily anticipate and certainly had not prepared for, is the key fact in understanding his leadership. Because he was forced by the circumstances of the war to learn on the job of commander-in-chief. And I think that part of his career, his life, his presidency has probably been relatively understudied in comparison with some other aspects of the story of Lincoln. And that's why I decided to write this book. It's not that we have been left in complete ignorance of the whole question of Lincoln's role as commander-in-chief, and there have been some very good studies of that in the past, but in the whole corpus of work about Abraham Lincoln, I think that it really has not been focused on in the way I tried to focus on it. He was totally preoccupied with the task of deciding what the war aims of the United States government ought to be, how the country could mobilize itself to achieve those war aims, what kind of strategy could win the war for the Union, what kind of a Union should emerge from this war. Would it be the old Union of 1861, a Union in which slavery had flourished in nearly half of the states and had polarized the country and brought on the war? Or should it be a war that brought forth a new birth of freedom, as Lincoln said at Gettysburg? All of these and other matters were connected with his role as commander-in-chief, and he spent more time in the War Department Telegraph Office following the events on several fronts across 1,000 miles of the United States, from Virginia to Arkansas and Missouri. And even west to New Mexico with the campaign that culminated at Glorieta Pass, and sending messages to far-flung fronts of the war. This was the story of Lincoln during the war. There were other parts of the Lincoln story during the war, of course, but this was the one that preoccupied him most. And his legacy coming down to the present really depends on how well he did the job as commander-in-chief. If he had lost the war, if the Union had lost the war, if the United States had divided into two countries, if slavery had not been abolished as a consequence of the war, as an essential part of Lincoln's strategy in the war, we would be a much different country today. So that's why I considered it to be crucial to understand that dimension of Lincoln's leadership.
I want to get to some of those particular aspects of Lincoln's shrewdness as commander-in-chief during the war, but certainly in presidential politics today, the military experience of presidential candidates or presidents themselves is something important. Can you walk us through a little bit of Lincoln's pre-Civil War military experience in terms of the Indian Wars of his time and any combat experience he may have had, or even military lessons and issues that he absorbed from that early part of his life?
Well, he had virtually no military experience to speak of. Back in 1832, when he was 23 years old and had just recently moved to the village of New Salem, the Black Hawk Indians, which had been forced to cross the Mississippi River into Iowa, returned across the river to Illinois in alleged violation of the treaty they had signed to leave Illinois. Which brought on a short-lived war called the Black Hawk War, in which several militia units in Illinois, as well as part of the regular United States Army, were mobilized. Lincoln decided to enlist along with a lot of his friends, and they elected him captain of this militia unit. But his militia unit saw no action against the Indians. And as a consequence, Lincoln subsequently mocked his own military career when he was a congressman during the Mexican War in 1848, a war in which he really opposed the America going to war and opposed his presidential administration of James K. Polk that had taken America to war against Mexico back in 1846. And in fact, Lincoln was giving what really amounted to an anti-war speech on the floor of the House, during which he diverted to make fun of his own military career. And on the floor of the House in a speech, he said, do you know that I'm a military hero? I made several charges upon the wild onions and had a good many bloody struggles with the mosquitoes. So that was really the extent of Lincoln's military service. And the one war before the Civil War that was fought in his mature years, the Mexican-American War, he'd been a child during the War of 1812, was a war he opposed, and he opposed American policy in that war. So it could not be said that he had any preparation at all for what became the huge task that he had to perform in the Civil War.
When the war breaks out, many, if not most Americans, seem to believe that it'll be very short-lived, that this will be essentially a skirmish between North and South, and depending on which side your loyalties broke, one side would be victorious. Did Lincoln have a similar view, or did he perhaps think that the war would be protracted?
Lincoln never went on record saying how long and how hard and how violent he thought this war would be. But we can tease out from some of his convictions and some of his statements the supposition that he did not expect it to be anything like the 4 years of extraordinarily violent and bloody war that resulted in the deaths of 620,000 to 625,000 soldiers. Lincoln shared an assumption with large numbers of Republicans in the North in 1861, an assumption that the silent majority of the Southern people really remained Unionists at heart. They were closet Americans, but had been swept into support for secession during the passions that followed the presidential election of 1860. And that if he could combine firmness in rejecting the legitimacy of secession with conciliation in the policy toward the South, that they would come to their senses and return to their ancestral loyalty to the United States. He made a very eloquent appeal along those lines in the peroration of his inaugural address on March 4th, 1861. As late as the 4th of July, when he sent his message to a special session of Congress he had called, and now the war is 3 months old, he said that it does not appear that in any state, except possibly South Carolina, he said, a majority of the Southern people really support secession. Well, that turned out to be wrong, and Lincoln was not the only one who believed this. It was clear that the majority of Southern people, at least in the first seven states that seceded, and certainly a substantial number of people in the other four states that seceded after the war broke out at Fort Sumter, did in fact support the Confederate war effort. And that was what made it a long and hard and violent war. But that wasn't clear yet to Lincoln and to most other Northerners in the spring and summer of 1861. And from these words that I've just quoted to you about Lincoln's ideas that there would be a reassertion of loyalty in the South if you could just slap the hands of those leaders that had taken the South out of the Union, the loyal majority, the silent majority, if you will, would eventually bring those states back in the Union. It took a long time for that assumption to die. Once it did die, and for Lincoln, I think that that happened over the winter of 1861 and 1862. Then Lincoln did become convinced that this was going to be a long, hard war, that it was going to require a kind of total war strategy in order to accomplish the restoration of the Union, that the South wasn't going to come back voluntarily. They were going to have to be compelled by force, overwhelming force, to do so.
Talk to us a little bit about this notion of the legitimacy or illegitimacy of secession. Lincoln, throughout the war, like many a president that leads the United States into war, has to become a bit of a constitutional scholar, or ought to become a bit of a constitutional student. Lincoln's perception, seems to me, is that constitutionally, secession is a null set. It can't exist. That, in other words, it's impossible to do, and that it renders the war almost a police action against traitorous or rebellious Americans. Is that the perception from the beginning, and is that the perception he carries throughout the war?
From the very beginning through the end, Lincoln regarded secession as illegitimate and unconstitutional. And in his inaugural address and in this message to Congress in July 1861 and at various other times during the war, he expressed that sentiment. He argued that the United States, in the form of the Continental Congress, really preceded the existence of the individual states who, at the time the Continental Congress formed the United States, were still colonies. That the states would have not had any existence outside of the United States, that the Articles of Confederation, which governed the United States from 1781 until 1789, said that the union created by these articles shall be perpetual. Then the preamble to the United States Constitution says that the purpose of this Constitution is to form a more perfect union, more perfect than perpetual. So Lincoln appealed to these documents from the founding era of the United States. But he went beyond that to argue that the United States was almost the only republic of any size and consequence in the 19th century world in which most countries were ruled by kings, by monarchs, by czars, by an aristocracy, by a ruling class. The United States had been founded on a different idea, and if secession succeeded in tearing the United States apart, it would completely discredit the whole idea of democracy. It would prove to skeptical Europeans who had been saying this all along that republics could never exist, could never survive. So this, and this is what Lincoln said at Gettysburg, this Civil War was a great test whether a nation so conceived on the basis of the Declaration of Independence can long endure or will perish from the earth. So both constitutionally and in a kind of ideological sense, Lincoln was a firm nationalist who said that the secession of the South, if it were allowed to succeed, would be a violation of the Constitution, but a violation of everything that the United States was founded upon. He also, on one occasion, described secession as the essence of anarchy, because if one state may secede, so may any or all of them, and you have no nation, you have no government, you have no constitution if any state can get out of it at will. So that was his constitutional argument, and he buttressed it by this appeal to patriotism, to ideology. I think Lincoln and a majority of the Northern people, that's why they fought this war, regarded secession as a disastrous precedent, which, if allowed to succeed, would be invoked in the future by other disaffected minorities in the United States, so that the United States would not merely break up into two nations, as it did in 1861, but into three, four, or more, that the map of North America would come to look like the map of South America.
How do you square that particular and even crystalline argument about the Constitution and its organic qualities and its perpetual qualities with Lincoln's position with, say, the suspension of habeas corpus or another constitutional challenge that we rarely put under this bracket, the issuance of the Emancipation Proclamation?
Lincoln based both of these actions, which were two of the most consequential actions he did take during the war, on his war powers as commander-in-chief. Now, if you go and take a look at the Constitution, it does not define, the words war powers don't exist in the Constitution. The phrase commander-in-chief does exist in the Constitution, but all it says is that the president shall be commander-in-chief of the army and the navy and of the militia of the various states when called into federal service, period. It does not describe the duties, the responsibilities, the limitations of the president's role as commander-in-chief. That was a kind of blank slate on which Lincoln wrote the duties of commander-in-chief. And in that first message to Congress on July 4th, 1861, he used the phrase war powers twice. He was the first president ever to use that phrase, as far as we can determine. What were those war powers, and what were they derived from? They were derived from the constitutional provision making the president commander-in-chief. What were those duties? Well, Lincoln had taken an oath of office to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. That was his preeminent duty. And he argued that the war power, which he basically invented, gave him the authority to do whatever was necessary to fulfill that supreme duty. that is to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution, that is the integrity of the United States. And so one of the first actions he took was to declare a blockade of the Confederate coast, which is an act of war, and in effect preempted the congressional duty or the congressional right, which is exclusively the right of Congress, to declare war. So here he is appropriating a kind of duty based on commander-in-chief. The United States had been attacked, so he begins to take actions that are really constitute a war. He then suspends the writ of habeas corpus. That actually is authorized by the Constitution, although it's not clear from the Constitution who has the right to do it. The Constitution says in its somewhat typical passive voice and negative voice that the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless, in cases of rebellion or invasion, the public interest requires it. Well, here we had a clear case of rebellion. But the Chief Justice of the United States, Roger B. Taney, says that only Congress had the right to do that. That provision of the Constitution is in Article 1, which outlines the duties and responsibilities of Congress. Lincoln came back and said that is clearly a function of the Commander-in-Chief in an emergency, in a crisis of rebellion. And so he did it. And the Emancipation Proclamation was based on the same concept of the war powers to do whatever was necessary to preserve, protect, and defend the United States. A field general has the right to take enemy property that's being waged war against the United States, to destroy railroads, to destroy factories, to destroy crops in the fields that are being used to feed enemy soldiers. Lincoln, as commander-in-chief, said he had the same right to expropriate enemy property being used to wage war against the United States under his war powers. And of course, the enemy property that the Emancipation Proclamation expropriated were slaves. Slaves were property. They were being used to wage war against the United States because they constituted the principal labor force of the Confederacy. They supported the logistics of the Confederate armies. And so Lincoln based the Emancipation Proclamation on that same concept of his constitutional duty, his war powers, under the Commander-in-Chief Clause of the Constitution, to do whatever was necessary to win this war and preserve the Union.
Before we turn to a discussion of Lincoln's role in generalship or choosing and supporting particular generals over others and his military stratagems, I want to talk a little bit about Lincoln the man and the war. This is clearly a president consumed by the war. It seems entirely clear to me that he thought about it all the time. He's congenitally sad and melancholy to begin with and seems to have been shattered by the war. But do you think, is that true? And also, do you think that, in fact, his vulnerability to the tragedy of the war at the personal or individual level, much less the army or regional level, that his vulnerability is in part what made him such a good commander-in-chief?
I think so. I think he felt every one of those deaths in the war, and that would include Confederate deaths as well, personally. His private secretary, John Hay, who became very close to Lincoln during the war, Lincoln's own son, Robert, was away at Harvard during most of the war, and John Hay, who was almost the same age as Robert Lincoln, became a kind of surrogate son for Lincoln, as well as carrying out many confidential duties for the president. Hay and his co-secretary, John Nicolay, both slept in a room near Lincoln's at the White House. And Hay talks in his diary about hearing Lincoln late into the night pacing up and down the floor, worrying about the war, feeling the burden of the war on his shoulders. In 1864, an artist named Francis Carpenter stayed in the White House for 6 months while he painted a famous picture of Lincoln reading the first draft of the Emancipation Proclamation to his cabinet. It hangs in the United States Senate today, this painting, this famous painting. And Carpenter talks about how Lincoln would be up all night during key parts of the Grant's Overland campaign in the spring of 1864. He couldn't sleep. He looked ghastly. He was pacing the floor. If you take a look at the photographs of Lincoln, and he was a much photographed president, taken over the 4 years of the war, you'll see a man who ages 5 years every year during that war, so that by 1865, he looks like he's, instead of just being 56 years old, which is his age in 1865, he looks like a 75-year-old man. So clearly, here is somebody who felt the weight of this of the war on his shoulders, in his heart, and yet he, as he once told an audience in Philadelphia, during the worst part of the war in the spring and summer of 1864, we began this war for a worthy cause, and no matter how much it costs, we're going to have to follow it through until we achieve that cause.
Let's talk a little bit about his generalship or his military shrewdness as the war goes on. Many an American knows about his frustration with his generals, particularly General McClellan, who seem reluctant to, at certain points in the war, either go into the field at all or to claim battlefield gains by further success. How clearly does Lincoln see the war unfolding from Washington, and is he a prominent or even profound military thinker in his own right?
Well, he was not a profound military thinker in his own right at first. As we mentioned a few moments ago, he had no military training and a comical military experience in the Black Hawk War, and so he had to learn on the job. He studied very hard. The studying took the form of talking to anybody and listening to anybody who could answer his questions. He was, as a lawyer, he had been a very skillful cross-examiner, and he continued to be a very skillful cross-examiner when he would talk to General Winfield Scott, his first general-in-chief, or talk to Quartermaster General Montgomery Meigs, when he would later talk to George B. McClellan and ask him questions about military strategy, command decisions, and so on. And that's one way he learned. He also learned just by observation. When he's in the telegraph office and getting reports from the front, he's a very astute reader of the information that's coming in from generals at the front. And he would read the reports, after-action reports of battles, too, at a time when he was becoming increasingly disillusioned with McClellan and McClellan's failure to use that terrific army that he was in the process of creating, the Army of the Potomac. Lincoln began to read everything he could get his hands on about military history and military strategy. He took these lessons to heart, and I think that by early 1862, he had a very shrewd grasp of the kind of military strategy that was going to be necessary to win this war. And it was about this time also that he had completely lost faith in the residual unionism, the closet Americanism of these Confederates, and was now convinced that the only way that he was going to win the war was through aggressive offensive strategy that not merely invaded and occupied territory in the South, but went after Confederate armies, because the Confederate nation existed on the back of its armies. Without those armies, there would have been no Confederate nation, and the only way that the Confederate nation was going to be overcome and the states brought back into the United States was to defeat those armies, to go after those armies. And one of the problems with McClellan is that he didn't do it. And Lincoln had the same problem with some of his other generals, especially in the Eastern or Virginia theater of the war.
Do you want to share the contents of the famous telegram to McClellan about the use of your army?
There was a time in January 1862 when McClellan had actually come down with typhoid fever, and Lincoln was frustrated by the lack of action not only in that theater but in the Western Theater, and he held a meeting with some of the other generals who happened to be in Washington, and he said that if McClellan didn't want to use the army, he'd like to borrow it. And that was Lincoln's way of saying, and at the time he said that, he was getting advice from his Attorney General, Edward Bates, that he ought to be more assertive Lincoln ought to be more assertive in exercising his powers and duties as commander-in-chief. And I think that advice also was part of Lincoln's learning process, that not only as commander-in-chief did he have the right to do things like suspend habeas corpus and seize enemy property, but he also should be much more should be a much more hands-on commander-in-chief in dealing directly with the armies, especially if his general-in-chief, who was also, he wore two hats, McClellan did at that time, commander of the Army of the Potomac, wasn't doing anything.
I want to ask you a little bit about this notion of going after the Confederate Army, because there's a chapter, and it's discussed elsewhere in the book, but there's a chapter in the book about destruction of the Confederate landscape versus destruction of the Confederate Army, and Lincoln does continually say, go after the Army, go after the Army. Is there a tension there in the Civil War between a kind of totalizing aspect of the Civil War, as maybe one of the first, if not first, modern wars in that respect, and a much more traditional approach that you cut the head off your opponent by going after and destroying the army? Did Lincoln feel that tension amongst his own generals and the progress of the war and hew to this quite traditional but commonsensical line?
Well, I think that there was a difference in the sort of idea of how to win this war, the difference between most of the high-ranking generals in the Eastern Theater, starting with McClellan, well, really starting with Winfield Scott, who was a Virginian and really wanted, he came up with what was called in the press the Anaconda Plan, which was to seal off the Confederacy from the rest of the world by a blockade and then just leave him to die on the vine rather than to invade and really get involved in a hard-fought war. But then McClellan and some of the other Eastern generals had the idea that this was a war between armies led by gentlemen who had gone together who had known each other as fellow cadets at West Point and as fellow officers in the pre-war army. And so the idea, and this was true of McClellan, I think it was true of some of the people in his, its corps and division commanders, that this was not a war against the Southern people, it was not a war against Southern property, it was not a war to overthrow Southern institutions. It was a war between armies led by professional gentlemen. And part of the problem, I think, with some of the failures and frustrations of Union military operations in the Eastern Theater in the first half of the war was that mindset among many of the generals who had been brought up under McClellan's leadership in that army. A different mindset existed in the West. And in those days, the West constituted anything west of the Appalachian Mountains. So we're talking about Tennessee, we're talking about Mississippi, Kentucky, Arkansas, Louisiana, where generals like Grant and Sherman and Sheridan came up first as colonels, then as brigadier generals, commanding brigades, then divisions, and then, of course, Grant becomes commander of the Army of the Tennessee. And the war out there from very early on was a war fought over larger distances, a war of where guerrilla warfare behind Union lines invited retaliation, especially in a state like Missouri, but also in Kentucky and Tennessee. So it became a hard war and not a war merely between armies commanded by gentlemen. And Lincoln, of course, was a product of the West, a product of the frontier, born in Kentucky, grew up in Indiana and Illinois when they were frontier states. He resonated with that. He began to see that that was what was going to have to be done to win this war. And it wasn't really until some of these Western generals were brought east. Grant as general-in-chief in March 1864, and he made his headquarters with the Army of the Potomac. Sheridan, who became commander of the Army of the Potomac's cavalry and then commander of the Army of the Shenandoah. Sherman, who launched the campaign in Georgia in the spring of 1864, that you get to a kind of war that was much different from the way it had been envisaged back in 1861 and 1862 and had been carried out until at least 1863 in the Eastern Theater. And I think Lincoln grasped as early as anybody and earlier than most of his Eastern generals the conviction, the understanding that this had become a war not merely between armies and indeed not merely between governments, but a war between peoples in which the will of the enemy population and the economic resources of the enemy economy and population were something that sustained the war and must be attacked and destroyed if the war was to be won.
I hadn't thought about it before in terms of the eastern-western divide of those generals, but there's a notion that we know that Lincoln had a number of ineffectual generals, but he also had a number of brilliant and perhaps even ruthlessly brilliant generals, many of whom you just mentioned coming out of the Western theater. How good is he at spotting that kind of talent, and does he make mistakes?
Well, I think one of the biggest contributions Lincoln made to winning the war and preserving the United States was to identify Grant early in the war as having the potential to become the kind of general that Lincoln needed and wanted to win the war. He had his eye on Grant from the time Grant captured Forts Henry and Fort Donelson in February 1862. And very soon after that, Grant got in trouble with General Henry W. Halleck, who was his superior in that theater. Halleck mistakenly thought that Grant had disobeyed orders. It turned out there was a Confederate sympathizer in the telegraph office in Illinois who was suppressing the messages between Halleck and Grant, and Halleck thought that Grant was disobeying orders and was not making reports. And that word got back to Washington, and McClellan, who was then general-in-chief, authorized Halleck to remove Grant unless he shaped up. Well, Lincoln saw this telegraph traffic, and he had the adjutant general make inquiries of Halleck about, you know, what's the problem with Grant? Here he's won this great victory. And Halleck backed down. Later on, after the Battle of Shiloh in April 1862, there was an outcry against Grant for having been surprised there and almost losing that battle and suffering enormous casualties, which shocked the country, and rumors that he was drunk. And again, Lincoln sends inquiries out there, says, you know, what's the reality here? What's the truth of this? And word comes back that most of this is just rumor and gossip. And again, a year later, during the early stages of the Vicksburg campaign, there's an outcry against Grant again because the early stages, there were a lot of mistakes, a lot of failures, and that before Grant really took hold and prosecuted that campaign brilliantly. And again, Lincoln comes to Grant's aid and comes to Grant's defense. So clearly, here is the president and commander-in-chief who has identified Grant and is defending him through thick and thin, and demanding that those people who claim that Grant was surprised, or Grant was drunk, or Grant was just incompetent, prove their case, and they couldn't prove the case. And so Lincoln identifies Grant. You asked about mistakes. I think some of the mistakes that Lincoln made grew out of what we might call national strategy, undermining military strategy. Well, what do I mean by that? Part of Lincoln's national strategy, that is to mobilize the support of the population for this war effort, was to appoint a large number of prominent politicians to high-ranking positions as brigadier or major general, people like Nathaniel Banks, Benjamin Butler, John McClernand. And the purpose of that was to mobilize their constituencies to support the war effort. Some of these were Democrats, and Lincoln needed the Democrats to support this war. He appointed a number of ethnic leaders, German Americans and Irish Americans, in order to mobilize those communities, those constituencies for the war effort. But some of these people, like Banks and Butler, McClernand, were commissioned as brigadier or major general so early in the war that by seniority they outranked some of the professional West Point educated officers at subsequent stages in the war, and had commands that they were not competent really to carry out, so there were problems between Grant and McClernand, which I think Lincoln contributed to by appointing McClernand to a responsible position that was beyond his capacities. If Grant had originally, in the Vicksburg campaign in early 1863, if Grant had originally followed Lincoln's suggestion after getting across the Mississippi River to go down and join Banks to try to capture Port Hudson near Baton Rouge, Louisiana, first before the two armies then moved back north again to go after Vicksburg, Banks would have actually outranked Grant. And Banks was relatively incompetent as a commander. So some of the mistakes that Lincoln made in terms of putting less competent commanders into responsible positions that were beyond their capacity were really a consequence of his earlier decision to appoint these people in order to mobilize their constituency to support the war effort. Now, is that a mistake or is that just a inevitable consequence of kind of clashing priorities? Well, you can make either case, I think.
In this notion of galvanizing support for the war effort, Lincoln's a master at the public relations campaign, if you will, throughout even the darkest days of the war, talking about the absolute necessity of preserving the Union. And he seems to do this through personality, speech, and print alone, really. And given our technologically sophisticated age and the difficulties to seemingly address similar issues, what's his particular genius in this, in keeping the public relations campaign, it's not quite the right phrase, but I think you understand my point, keeping it alive in the North for the war effort? What's his particular insight there?
Well, Lincoln could be a magician with words. Words on paper, earlier in his career, like the Lincoln-Douglas debate, words in oratory. And he became a master of what we might call the public letter, which would be analogous, I guess, to a president in a news conference today. In explaining a policy decision or a strategic decision through a public letter which found its way into the newspapers and was read broadly by everybody. His famous letter to Horace Greeley about the question of the relationship between the Union and slavery in August 1862 was a brilliant effort to prepare the public opinion for the Emancipation Proclamation that Lincoln knew was coming, but Greeley didn't know and the public didn't know it was coming, by saying that whatever he did about slavery, he did because it would preserve the Union, because he knew that the cause of preserving the Union united the Northern people, whereas the question of slavery and emancipation divided them. And he is using this letter as a way of convincing those people who would be opposed to emancipation that when it came, it would be done not for its own sake, but because it was necessary to preserve the Union, which is a value, a goal that they supported. In 1863, he wrote several public letters on the issue of the suspension of habeas corpus and the trial of civilians by military courts, which had caused an outcry, especially after the leading peace Democrat or Copperhead, Clement Vallandigham, had been arrested and convicted by a military court of treason, of opposing the war. Lincoln publishes a couple of public letters in response to this criticism, to this outcry, which disarms much of that criticism in a kind of folksy way, but at the same time a hard-nosed extrapolation of the Constitution. And he does this on several occasions during the war. In early 1864, he goes to Baltimore, he goes to Philadelphia, and gives major speeches before at what were called fairs for the United States Sanitary Commission to raise money for this organization that was an auxiliary of the Medical Corps of the Union Army that helped save many lives. And in these speeches, he talks about, it's in one of these speeches that he said, we began this war for a worthy cause, and no matter how much it costs, we're going to have to go through and achieve that cause. And on and on. He was a master at using words in order to explain in a way that I think nobody else could, with clarity, with humor, with language that everybody could understand. The Gettysburg Address, of course, is the outstanding example of this. What this war was about, and what the goals were for fighting this war, and why it was necessary to do that.
How does he, back to the Greeley case about softening up, in essence, the North for the coming of the Emancipation Proclamation, how does he juggle that on one hand with his dealings with the African-American population, Frederick Douglass in particular, about either emancipation or maybe most particularly arming and putting in uniform free African-Americans?
Well, Lincoln initially was very cautious and in public even opposed to arming blacks, because he knew that arms in the hands of black men, especially former slaves, were the worst nightmare of many white Americans. And so he had to move carefully and cautiously on this issue, but in pretty much the same way as he did about emancipation in the Greeley letter, he begins to talk about the necessity, the importance of arming blacks in order to help them, not only to help them achieve their own freedom, but help to preserve the Union. And again, it's the same point. You may not like blacks. You may not like the idea of putting them in uniform, but you are for preserving the Union, and this is going to help us preserve the Union. So you're going to have to subordinate your opposition and your prejudice to the larger goal. And he was very effective at doing that. And once black soldiers began to make an important contribution and to demonstrate their courage, as they did at Fort Wagner in the attack that is, of course, the subject of the movie Glory, which I'm sure many of the people here have seen at one time or another, Lincoln is then eloquent in praising their contribution. He talks, Frederick Douglass comes twice to the White House in 1863 to talk with Lincoln about some of the problems with black soldiers. At first, they were not paid the same amount as white soldiers. They did not have the opportunity at first to become officers, and in fact, very few of them ever did become officers during the Civil War. And Lincoln is telling Douglass, look, we have to take this one step at a time. We had to overcome first all of this opposition to putting black people in the uniform. We're going to have to take it one step at a time to give them equal pay and to give them opportunities for promotion. But it's going to come, he assures Douglass. So I think Lincoln, one of the secrets of his success is that he is neither too far behind the dynamic evolution of the war or too far out ahead of it so that the public won't go along with it. He has a sensitive finger on the pulse of public opinion and an ability to move it in the direction he wants it to go by nudging it, not by getting too far out ahead and trying to yank it forward.
And had he lived?
Had he lived, would Reconstruction have been different? Well, one thing we can say is if Lincoln had lived, there would not have been the polarization and bitterness in Washington between the Republican majority in Congress and the President of the United States over the issues of Reconstruction that led by 1868 to the impeachment of Andrew Johnson and his escape from conviction by merely one vote in the Senate. And that poisonous relationship between Congress and the President in Washington, I think, poisoned the whole process of Reconstruction. And most importantly of all, it encouraged Southern white resistance to Reconstruction because they believed that they had the President of the United States, Andrew Johnson, a Tennessean and a former Democrat, on their side. If Lincoln had lived, that never would have happened. And I think the poisonous atmosphere in Washington, which spread its toxicity, if you will, south into the Reconstruction on the ground in the South would have been much different. And I think the process probably would have gone forward with less violence, less resistance, and maybe more success.
It's not hard to tell. This is one of our most eloquent interpreters of American history, and I'd like to offer Jim the final part of this formal part of the program, the chance to read from the epilogue, which takes up in a different sort of summative way Lincoln as Commander-in-Chief. So do you care to read from that?
Just briefly. I end the last chapter of the book before the what I call the epilogue with a speech that Lincoln gave 2 days after the surrender of the Army of Northern Virginia at Appomattox. He gave a speech in Washington on April 11th, 1865, and the subject of that speech was Reconstruction. And in the course of the speech, he talks about his hope that in the Reconstruction process, black soldiers, veterans of the Union Army, and literate Southern blacks will have the right to vote. And he then says, in a few days, I'm going to make a new announcement about Reconstruction. Well, one of the people in the audience Lincoln gave this speech from a second floor window of the White House, as he sometimes did to crowds that came to serenade him at the White House. And one of the listeners in the crowd on this occasion turned to his companion. "That means nigger citizenship," snapped John Wilkes Booth. "Now, by God, I'll put him through. That is the last speech he will ever make." That's how I end the final chapter of the book, and then turning the page over to Reconstruction, to the epilogue, I'm sorry. Let me just read a couple of pages here. Booth carried out his ugly threat 3 days later. A native of Maryland who supported the Confederacy, he hated the Union Commander-in-Chief for his success in winning the war and abolishing slavery. Granting equal rights to freed slaves would add insult to injury. So Booth, quote, put him through. If Lincoln had been a failure, he would have lived a longer life. Failure had often seemed imminent. Several times during the war, Union prospects were dark. 3 times in particular stand out. After the Confederate victory at Second Manassas in August 1862, demoralization in the Eastern Union armies and among the Northern people reached dire levels. Lincoln made the difficult decision, opposed by his cabinet and by principal congressional leaders, to give McClellan command of the reconstituted Army of the Potomac. Victory at Antietam followed, though Lincoln was grievously disappointed with McClellan's failure to follow it up and, quote, destroy the rebel army, which Lincoln had said you should try to do. Again, in the spring of 1863, the North seemed on the verge of defeat, as Grant's army apparently floundered in the swamps near Vicksburg, and Lee's army headed north after its spectacular victory at Chancellorsville. Lincoln once again made difficult decisions to keep Grant in command and to replace Joe Hooker with George Gordon Meade. The capture of Vicksburg and victory at Gettysburg followed, but Lee got back to Virginia without further major damage to Lincoln's distress. A year later, in the summer of 1864, Union prospects seemed to sink almost out of sight. Lincoln resisted enormous pressure to seek a compromise peace and to back away from emancipation. He stayed the course, despite universal expectations that it would cost his reelection. The capture of Atlanta, victories in the Shenandoah Valley, and reelection followed. So did Appomattox and assassination. Lincoln's on-the-job training as Commander-in-Chief went through some rough patches. He made mistakes, but he also learned from those mistakes. He deferred too long to McClellan's supposedly superior professional qualifications. Perhaps he should have overruled the general's preference for the peninsula strategy. He gave command responsibilities beyond their capacities to such political generals as Fremont, McClernand, Banks, and Butler. In retrospect, it appears that he also made several wrong appointments to command the Army of the Potomac. Yet in each case, the general he named seemed to be the best man for the job when he was appointed. McClellan was everyone's choice when he took command in July 1861. Burnside had achieved success with an independent command in North Carolina and seemed the logical choice in December 1862. Hooker was a controversial choice, but he did everything right in his first 3 months of command and appeared to have vindicated Lincoln's decision until he stumbled at Chancellorsville. Meade was a consensus choice, and despite Lincoln's disappointment with him after Gettysburg, he remained commander of the Army of the Potomac through its final triumph. Likewise, the choices of McClellan and then Halleck as general-in-chief looked like the right appointments at the right time. No one was more disappointed with their shortcomings than the president himself. Their failures put a greater burden on Lincoln to function as his own general-in-chief during much of the war, until he did make the right choice at the right time when he named Grant to this position in March 1864. The visibility of commanding generals who turned out to be disappointments, which would also include Buell and Rosecrans, should not distract us from Lincoln's key role in placing Grant, Sheridan, Thomas, and, indirectly through his support of Grant, Sherman, in top commands and keeping them there until they won the war.
Jim, I want to take my prerogative here to just before we segue into questions, to thank Jim for not only this book and this evening, which has really been wonderful and exciting, but to thank you publicly for a career's worth of insightful and beautifully written, brilliantly researched, and very, very important work about the American past. Thank you, Jim. We have time for questions. Please wait till the mic comes around. There is no dumb question. There is a long question. So please please act accordingly. Let's go. Where are our mics? Got mics both places. Let's go up front here, Louise, if we can, or Justin.
What would you say are the differences between Lincoln as commander-in-chief and our current commander-in-chief?
Well, I'll betray my biases here now, I'm sure. I think Lincoln was commander-in-chief in a just war, a war that had to be fought. I think the current president has been commander-in-chief and not a very effective one, in at least one war that should never have been fought. And has diverted resources from the war in Afghanistan, which I think is really more important as part of the war on terror. There were times, of course, during the course of during the Civil War when things were not going well, and Lincoln was subject to the same kinds of criticism for ineffectiveness and mistakes and so on that the current president has been on more than one occasion. In the end, of course, we look back and Lincoln was successful and then was cut down at the moment of success, which turned him into a martyr as well as a victorious commander-in-chief. It's obviously too soon for us to look back on the last 8 years, but in my own judgment, they're not likely to turn George Bush into Abraham Lincoln.
Let's go over here. Thanks, Libby.
I have a question that's been bothering me for a long time. Lincoln liked to spend time with the Army, and he spent as much time as he could with the Army of the Potomac. But I don't think he ever visited the Army in the West or any of the commanders in the West. I think the first time he met Grant was in March of 1864 when he appointed him commander-in-chief. Why? Why didn't he make the effort?
I think the short answer to that question, or two short answers to that question, are first, it's the squeaky wheel that gets the grease. And the squeaky wheel in the Union military effort was the Army of the Potomac. And one of the reasons that Lincoln did visit them on several occasions was to try to get them going, to try to gauge the morale of the Army and the morale of the commanders. That's why he went to the peninsula after the failure of the Seven Days battles in July 1862. That's why he went to see McClellan after Antietam, when McClellan hadn't done anything in the 2 weeks after Antietam. And the other short answer is that that's the Army close to Washington, and Lincoln felt that he could not be absent from Washington long enough to go all the way out to Mississippi or Louisiana, but he didn't really need to, because for the most part those armies were successful, and didn't need the direct kind of oversight. that he felt the Army of the Potomac did.
Right here in the front, and then we'll go there.
I have a question about the great emancipator. Today, that's how we think of Lincoln. But isn't it really the case that the war began in 1861, and Lincoln was interested in preserving the Union, and that emancipation was nowhere on the horizon, and that this eventually developed 2 years later, and as a tool towards preserving the Union, and that today we look back through the prism and we see Lincoln as the great emancipator, but that wasn't really how he saw the war and how he saw his role?
Well, I think that's an oversimplification of the case. If we go back to Lincoln's House Divided speech with which he launched his campaign for the Senate in 1858, he said in that case, in that time, that there was this great conflict between slavery and freedom. And the conflict focused on the question of expansion of slavery into the territories. And he, Lincoln, and his party were pledged to the restriction of slavery, its expansion into the territories, as a way of putting it on in the course of ultimate extinction. And on many occasions in the 1850s, Lincoln said that slavery is a social, moral, and political evil, an evil to the white man, to the Negro, and to the state. During the war, he said that if slavery is not wrong, nothing is wrong. I cannot remember when I did not so believe. So clearly we have Lincoln here as somebody who looks forward to a time when slavery will come to an end, and the policy of the party to which he belonged and which he was the leader was to start it on the first step towards steps toward ultimate extinction. The war merely accelerated that process. Well, I shouldn't say merely. The war accelerated that process. And even before the Emancipation Proclamation, as early as November of 1861, Lincoln is in conversations with leading unionists in the border slave states that had remained loyal to the Union, trying to persuade them voluntarily to pass state legislation taking the first steps toward abolishing slavery in those states, starting with Delaware, where there were only 2,000 slaves. And then they would receive federal compensation if they would do it. And he actually gets Congress to pass a resolution in March 1862 offering federal compensation to the states, if they abolish, these are the loyal border states. So he is taking these steps even before the Emancipation Proclamation, which I agree with you, was a military measure to weaken the Confederacy, and it was sold to the public as a military measure to help win the war. But I think that a pro-slavery president would not have issued such a proclamation because it would have been inconsistent with his convictions. The Emancipation Proclamation is actually consistent with Lincoln's convictions, and I think he saw it as a crucial step toward abolishing slavery, but it can only be sold to the public and it can only be constitutionally justified as a war measure to weaken the enemy by seizing property that's being used to wage war against the United States. So while it's quite true that these steps toward emancipation were part of an effort to win the war and were sold to the public primarily for that reason, I think that lurking behind that is a genuine conviction that this is an opportunity to bring an end to this institution, which has plagued the United States caused all Americans who subscribe to the idea that this is the land of the free to be hypocrites. I think Lincoln felt that inconsistency and that hypocrisy. In fact, he talked about it. And here was an opportunity to resolve that.
So right here, just in the middle.
You've discussed Lincoln's views of the powers of the president. How, in your view, would he look at the memorandums of somebody like John Yoo today, who discusses the powers of the presidency?
Well, that might require a long and detailed answer. Let me try to shorten it a little bit. Lincoln justified his suspensions or violations of civil liberties, suspension of habeas corpus, military tribunals to try civilians, on the grounds that this was a crisis in which the very survival of the United States was at stake. And because it was an extraordinary crisis, it required extraordinary measures. I do not think he would have considered the crisis of, or the issues of, the war on terror as threatening the very survival of the United States in anything like the Civil War did. And therefore, the kind of extraordinary measures and so on that he felt was were justified in 1861 would not be justified in 2001. That's how I, you know, that's the kind of short answer to that question.
Time for two more questions. Let's go right back there.
I was curious, you mentioned briefly about Frederick Douglass, and that sounds like a supportive relationship between Douglass and Lincoln. Was that sustained throughout the whole Civil War?
Douglass was at first a very bitter critic of Lincoln. He criticized him for, in 1861 and 1862, for slowness to move against slavery. He criticized Lincoln after Lincoln met with five black leaders from Washington, D.C. in August of 1862 to try to persuade them to encourage other free blacks to emigrate from the United States at a time when Lincoln was trying to defuse Northern racist hostility to the possibility of emancipation by encouraging the idea that that many blacks, once they were freed, might actually immigrate from the United States to Haiti or to some other part of the Western Hemisphere. And Douglass was bitterly critical of him for that. But once Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation and followed that up with a full-scale commitment to enlist blacks in the Union Army, and in fact Douglass helped to recruit blacks of the 54th and 55th Massachusetts, the first two black regiments organized in the North, and two of the most famous, especially the 54th. And two of Douglass's sons served in the 54th, one as Sergeant Major, the highest-ranking non-commissioned officer in the regiment. Douglass began praising Lincoln. And in 1863, he went to the White House twice and had long conversations with Lincoln, and reported very favorably on those conversations, said that he felt that Lincoln treated him as a man and not as a black man, that there was no condescension there at all. And Douglass thereafter became a very strong champion of Lincoln. Douglass, like many abolitionists who started out to be very critical of Lincoln and sometimes bitter critics of Lincoln, changed their minds during the course of the war as Lincoln moved closer and closer to their position, first on emancipation and then on black soldiers, and toward the end of his life on the question of civil and political rights for the freed slaves.
Let's hear from the back, all the way in the back. You can have our last question. Mm-hmm. Black in the black dress.
Hi, thank you. I have two quick questions. I was reading the Emancipation Proclamation actually today, and I never knew that there was parishes and cities that were exempted from certain states, and I didn't understand how that could happen, and were they exempt from total war then? That's one question. And my second question is, had Lincoln lived, do you think there would not be any KKK the way it is today or afterwards, since the military Confederate is the ones who started it?
Well, to answer your first question, yes, Lincoln did exempt certain parts of the South from the Emancipation Proclamation. He exempted the border slave states that remained loyal to the Union, Delaware, Kentucky, Tennessee, and he did exempt Tennessee, Kentucky, and Missouri, and what was now also becoming West Virginia. And he also exempted Tennessee and parts of Louisiana and Virginia. The reason he did that is because the legal or constitutional justification for the Emancipation Proclamation was that these regions were at war with the United States, where it applied. And therefore, the slaves were enemy property. But the four border slave states were loyal to the Union. Most of Tennessee was actually occupied by Union forces and therefore was deemed not to be at war with the United States. And the same was true with part of Louisiana and Virginia. So he exempted them because he believed he did not have the constitutional right. They were not enemy. They were not at war with the United States, and the Emancipation Proclamation was only supposed to apply legally to enemy property, to the slaves who were actually being used to wage war against the United States. It's a kind of a legal fiction, this distinction, but Lincoln wanted to make this an airtight legal doctrine, and so he didn't want any sloppiness saying, oh, well, I'm going to emancipate them everywhere. But it's clear, stop and think about it for a moment, it's clear that if slavery disappears from Mississippi and Louisiana and South Carolina and North Carolina, it's not going to survive in Tennessee and Kentucky and so on. And everybody realized that. Everybody also realized that the Emancipation Proclamation was a document very much like the Declaration of Independence. When the Declaration of Independence was signed on July 4, 1776, that didn't automatically and immediately make the United States an independent nation. They had to win the war in order to make that real. The same thing is true of the Emancipation Proclamation. They had to win the war to make that real. And once they won the war, slavery is clearly not going to survive in Kentucky and in Maryland and so on. And indeed, that's what happened. As far as the second question, if Lincoln had lived, would there have been a Ku Klux Klan and so on? Well, we can't know that for sure. I just hark back to my answer to Bill Devereaux a few moments ago, that I think the course of Reconstruction would have been quite different if Lincoln had lived, and maybe Southern resistance would have been less violent because Lincoln would have had more skill in kind of negotiating between North and South and conveying to the Southern people what they really needed to do in order to fulfill the requirements of Reconstruction, and would not have held out the encouragement to them to resist that they thought they were receiving from Andrew Johnson. And so maybe violent organizations like the Klan might not have sprung up in the South, but we can't know that for sure.
Well, with that, again, let me thank you all. Thank the Aloud folks for another wonderful program, and thanks to Jim McPherson.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.